Hello and welcome to the Witness History Podcast from the BBC World Service with me, Ben Henderson. Today, I'm taking you back to December 1992 and a speech delivered by Australia's then Prime Minister, Paul Keating, in a suburb of Sydney called Redfern.
It begins, I think, with an act of recognition. Recognition that it was we who did the dispossessing. We took the traditional lands and smashed the traditional way of life.
It was the first time an Australian Prime Minister took moral responsibility for the horrors inflicted upon the country's indigenous people by white settlers.
We took the children from their mothers. We practiced discrimination and exclusion.
The speech was remarkable. That is, for everyone except the man who wrote it.
I had no idea that it was going to be a big news speech at all. I still don't think it was anything like the best thing I ever wrote.
This is Don Watson. Back in 1992, Don was an academic and part-time speechwriter when he was offered a job writing speeches for the new Prime Minister, Paul Keating.
We became very good friends. He was very good off the cuff. John Howard, who was his great rival in a way, Howard came in one day and had sort of done a job on his teeth. You know, they'd cleaned him up to be leader. Paul insulted him and the Speaker demanded that he apologise and withdraw the remark. And Paul said, "Yes, well, I apologise, but I'll only withdraw if the Honourable Member for Bennelong will say suffer and succotash."
On a more serious note, the problems faced by Australia's Indigenous population were on Keating's mind. In 1991, an inquiry found Indigenous people were arrested at far higher rates than the rest of the population. The following year, Keating supported a controversial court decision that recognised the rights of Indigenous Australians to their ancestral land for the first time. He raised the subject with Don as they were flying to Sydney one day.
He looked down out of the plane and he said, "We're never going to get it right in this country until we get it right with the Indigenous people." And I thought, I knew from that brief moment that he believed very much in what turned out to be the Redfern speech.
1993 was the United Nations International Year of the World's Indigenous Peoples, and to mark it, Keating planned a speech at Redfern, which had a large Indigenous population.
I wrote this one the night before it was given. This was in my office in Parliament House, and it was just like any other night, the wind rattling the flagpole, with the night porter bringing me cups of tea. I didn't give it a huge amount of thought. I'd been a history academic, and I'd written a book on the frontier about the general dispossession and the horrors. So it was a History 1A speech.
The following morning, Keating steps up to a raised podium in sunny Redfern Park, speech in hand, while the crowd looks on expectantly.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here today at the launch.
You can hear at the beginning there's a lot of hubbub.
Yeah, it sounds like they're hecklers or something like hecklers.
Yeah, we've heard all this before sort of thing, you know.
There should be no. But after a slow start, Keating soon grabs the audience's attention.
Recognition that it was we who did the dispossessing. We took the traditional lands and smashed the traditional way of life.
That repetition of we, do you think that is what elevated the speech in many people's minds?
Oh, I think very much so, and particularly in the minds of the Aboriginal audience.
We brought the diseases and the alcohol. We committed the murders. We took the children from their mothers.
I do remember just one moment in the writing of it. You know, it was the empathetic switch. Imagine if this were done to us. It was to make white Australians come to some kind of understanding.
It was our ignorance and our prejudice and our failure to imagine that these things could be done to us.
Why do you think that line's so powerful?
Because I think because we're taking responsibility. Because it's a peculiar thing about the Australian frontier. The Americans, for instance, the frontier history hasn't been ignored, hidden in the way that frontier history here was. The great Australian silence.
It might help if we non-Aboriginal Australians imagined ourselves dispossessed of land we had lived on for 50,000 years, and then imagined ourselves told that it had never been ours.
When he starts saying, "We have to imagine this being done to us. Everything goes silent.
Imagine if non-Aboriginal Australians had served their country in peace and war and were then ignored in history books.
I was just surprised by how much coverage there was and how many people rang the office. It stunned me, really. And in the end, you know, there was a big backlash from Conservative Australia saying, why should this generation take responsibility for what other generations did?
I think we're beginning to see how much we owe the Indigenous Australians and how much we've lost by living so apart.
Some people say this was a huge moment in white Australia's reconciliation with Indigenous populations, whereas other people say it's just a speech, you know, nothing's changed. What do you say to those varying views?
I think both those positions are true. You know, it was part, I suppose, of a general enlivening of the relationship between Aboriginal leadership and white politicians. But the sad thing is, in the end, an awful lot was done to undo the progress we were making. We went back into denial about the truth of the frontier. And culture wars are wars you cannot win. But it's there. I mean, I'm glad it's in the record, and I think Paul deserves enormous credit for it.
We cannot imagine that the descendants of people whose genius and resilience maintained a culture here through 50,000 years or more, through cataclysmic changes to the climate and the environment, and who then survived two centuries of dispossession and abuse, will be denied their place in the modern Australian nations. We can't imagine that. We cannot imagine that we'll fail.
At the time, I felt, and I still do, that Keating did what no other politician would have done.
I'm confident that we won't fail. I'm confident we will succeed in this decade. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Ten years later, in 2002, Don published a book about his time working for Keating. He wrote that Keating didn't change a word of his draft speech. Don says he meant this as a compliment to Keating's willingness to say what needed to be said without watering it down. But Keating interpreted it as Don claiming the speech as his own.
He was very hostile. Yes, we had a few exchanges which I'd sooner forget.
How do you feel now, looking back on how your relationship with Paul Keating kind of deteriorated after the speech?
Oh, sad. You know, I curse the damn thing.
Well, on a more positive note, in 2007, ABC radio listeners voted it the third greatest speech of all time, which I'm sure you've heard many times.
I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, so it was after Jesus' Sermon on the Mount and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
That is totally insane.
But how does it make it feel that something you wrote is so fondly remembered?
I don't know quite what to say about that. It's sort of wonderful. I wish it had not been so clouded by Paul's unhappiness about it all. I think the power of the thing was that it said what needed to be said, that these things happened. And I'd never felt it such a privilege to write to Keating as I did listening to that speech. That remains true.
Don Watson went on to write a number of award-winning books. He was speaking to me, Ben Henderson, for the Witness History podcast from the BBC World Service. And if you want to hear more great speeches from history, just look in our back catalogue.
From the brilliant and bizarre.
It was really surreal. It was a surreal kind of atmosphere there. You couldn't really see anybody.
To the shocking and unexpected.
I'm just wondering, what are we going to do now? This was really my worst fear. He found 100% horse meat that was labelled as beef.
Witness the stories that have shaped our world. Told by the people who were there.
When he went to the factory, the poodle went in front of him. So the workers all knew, oh, the boss is here.
Many people had many things to lose by our victory. The future was not so bright.
Witness history.
We had a designer. He brought in a fully storyboarded idea about how the Queen would arrive by jumping out of a helicopter. And we all said, that's brilliant, but it's never going to happen.
Witness history at bbcworldservice.com/witnesshistory or wherever you get your podcasts.